I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 10 of Season 6 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic, It's a Wonderful Life, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me to close off the week is the MXM guru, Jim O'Kane. Welcome back, Jim. It's so much fun having you on the show.
It's great. You let me run my mouth off as long as we can talk, so it's fine.
We both do that. I think yeah. we both need to plead guilty on that one. But it's fun. It's a fun conversation, and that's the way that this is supposed to be.
And there's so much to talk about. Not much with this particular minute, but I think there's some really interesting little tidbits we can rummage through and chat about.
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, minute 10 begins with George come running into the office. You know, he's still sprinting. He hasn't stopped. You know, he's a little Forrest Gump, running everywhere he's got to go. And the minute ends with Peter Bailey standing up to Potter. Yeah. So yesterday, George was trying to figure out what to do about the poison issue. And instead of calling poison control, you know, he saw a cigarette ad that said, ask your dad. They're like, okay, why not? You know, and, I mean, this is probably a sign that he sees every single day that he's working in the drugstore. And just today is the day that it gave him this epiphany. Hey, there's a good idea. Why don't I go ask my father? So he runs away from there and runs past the Harry Potter magic carriage. And it must be magic because he runs up to the second floor and is, very quickly inside of this office. You know, it has a fan going. I've never understood the whole idea of having ribbons on a fan. Do you know the reason behind having that? Except for to tell us that the fan is working.
To tell the audience. I know in a submarine movie, it always means the vents have failed. and usually after the ribbons fall down, the next thing that happens is you get sweat marks in the shape of a T on everybody's shirt.
That's right.
So it's just telling you it's a stinking hot day down there in Bedford Falls, in early May too. So. It's very peculiar, but
theoretically it's early May, but we're going to get a little bit of a shot soon, and the calendar says that it's June.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of a problem there.
And it's awkwardly built, an awkwardly built office. I mean, it's built so that they can move giant cameras around, but for the style of the building, which I would assume would be like turn of the 19th into the 20th centuries. They have those windows atop the offices, but none of them are transoms. They don't look like they are able to be opened. You would think you would want to let the air waft out, but none of them seem to be movable. They just seem to be fixed there.
Yeah.
Even the outside windows don't have they just open from the bottom.
Well, that's why they have a fan. Come on.
Yeah. To blow stuff around the ceiling and not go anywhere.
That's right. And the lighting is great because you see that theoretically the sun is shining inside through the windows, and it reflects on those on the window of Peter Bailey's office, where you can see that it's his Bailey Brothers building and loan.
Yes, very clearly too. It's amazing how bright and perfectly focused the sun is today.
That's right.
I am fascinated as George runs in. He runs past the countertop, and there are apparently model houses.
Yes.
On the there's like a I think it's like a
the countertop.
A salt box style. Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out what types of houses. Like some kind of a colonial and one of those Amityville type houses with the gambrel roof, and then there's some other.
What this says to me is that Peter Bailey was the one who had the idea of doing Bailey Park, you know, before George does it a decade later.
Now, by a building and loan versus a savings loan, are they doing – I mean, they were going to establish Bailey Park. Are they also the general contractors for the houses?
Because, you know, George does mention later on to his father, you know, I don't want to be nickel and diming everything I do and trying to figure out a way to save a penny on a piece of pipe. So, he is – they are contracting it out because they're trying to give work to anyone that they can. But they're at the same time, they want to, give the cheapest price for the people building these houses.
Yeah, I was wondering what the other tenants in this building, as we saw yesterday, there were the stairs. There is a pawn shop that handles real estate and jewelry. So I was wondering if George's dad was in cahoots with the pawn shop as to, well, you can sell them your old house and we'll take those assets and put them in our building and loan and build you a house out there in Bailey Park.
That's interesting.
Just little unanswered questions that float around.
Yeah, there are many that we're going to come up with even today. And so George basically just wants to run right into his father's office without anything, and his uncle, Billy, stops him. Now, he has something in the pocket of his vest, which I can't tell what it is.
I keep reading it as Dutch Masters, like it's a box of cigarillos, but he's smoking a pipe, so that can't be right.
Right. So I don't know. He's holding a teacup with a saucer, and there's something protruding out of his pocket there.
And he looks like some kind of a record book. Yeah. And I wonder if that's a Patterson pipe that he's smoking from the drugstore across the street.
It's very possible.
Hmm.
And so then Billy says to him, "Oh, avast there, Captain Cook, where are you heading?" I guess he's into a seafaring. He's in a seafaring mood.
Yeah, and explore. He knows that the National Geographic Society has absorbed George Bailey, so he's going to go out and explore like Captain Cook, I would think.
That's right. That's right. And he goes, "I got to go see Pop, Uncle Billy. Some other time, George. It's important." And he goes, "There's a squall in there." Still talking about the adventure type of stuff. And, you find out that the other two characters that are here are apparently relatives, okay, because they're known as Cousin Tilly and Cousin Eustace. Right, but we're never really sure how they're related because they're apparently also Bailey's, and they're not Billy's kids and they're not Peter's kids. So maybe they have a sister or maybe they have another brother at some point that is the parent of these two. Basically, they're showing that this is definitely a family business.
Okay. Yeah.
Uncle Billy continues and says it's shaping up into a storm, and then Tilly goes, "Uncle Billy. Telephone? Who is it?" "Bank examiner." And he goes, "Bank examiner?" And then he looks at his hand and he sees that he has all of these strings attached to his hand, and he goes, "Oh, bank examiner." Basically, he's saying, "Oh crap, I forgot about that."
Yeah. His little memory aids were just not working.
No.
I must point out while he's standing there next to the coat and hat rack, there is a beautiful straw boater type hat hanging. I don't know if it's Peter's or if it's maybe Billy wears a boater, but
the one on the left, the one
barbershop quartet.
That's right. I was going to say the barbershop quartet. That was actually where I was thinking. I believe it is Billy's hat because Billy, we see him wearing it later.
Yeah. There's an interesting. It's actually a defining point of summer versus fall. And there was a day in the year that was known as Straw Hat Day, when people switched from their felt hats, their winter hats, to straw hats that signified the beginning of summer. And it varied what locale you were in and what everybody else was doing. So it was just a lot of peer pressure on this. And
is that an official day? Is there an official day called Straw Hat Day?
It varied by town. So it was that, but at the time, everybody, that's the day everybody switched to, you know, and they'd even mention it in the paper. This is Straw Hat Day, so make sure you swap out your straw hat. And it was considered very uncouth to not have a hat outdoors. So that would signify the beginning, basically the beginning of summer. So here in May, apparently it's like maybe the first week of May, they did Straw Hat Day. The reverse of that would be in either September or October, where you'd switch to Felt Hat Day. And you'd not wear your straw hat and wear your felt hat. Now, what teenage boys and young men, you know, like college age kids, would in some cities, there were men that would grab your straw hat and punch through it if you wore a straw hat after Felt Hat Day. In 1922, that rambunctious hijinks kind of thing would escalate into something that was known as the Straw Hat Riot, which lasted over a week. It lasted 8 days. It involved around 1,000 hat destroyers, resulted in a number of arrests and severe injuries. So, you know, hats were very serious business of the fashion of hats was very important. You could tell a person by the type of hat they wore, if they wore a fedora or a bowler. They were trying to express in a fashion statement what they were interested in. Boaters were considered, you were somewhat athletic, you were kind of upper class, and you had a very strong fashion sense, at least if you wore it during Straw Hat Days. But, you know, make sure you had on your fedora when that cold snap hit.
That's right. So that you don't, that someone doesn't punch through your hat at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. You know, Mary Poppins style. But it was, it's just interesting. I always wonder when I see older movies, you know, you see guys in fedoras and you'll see they're pinched a certain way, or they'll be wearing a bowler like Oliver Hardy. And it meant something, the little nuances of how you bent your hat, it meant something to people of the time. It's like, oh, that guy's the gangster. Oh, that guy thinks he's a tough guy. Oh, this guy, you know, and we don't have that language of what was going on in the fashion at the time. And you'd have to just kind of look up old fashion history to find out what these styles were.
Right. Sure. So, I mean, back to what we were saying before, this is May 3rd when this is all happening, yes. But the calendar in the Bailey building and loan is they're already living in the future. It's already June because of the calendar.
Or maybe it just took George a long time to get across the street.
It could be. you could also use the excuse that maybe it took a while for that telegram to actually get to Mr. Gower.
Yes.
it was a telegram lost in time.
Yeah. Wow.
I actually saw there were two pilots in the 1970s by Aaron Spelling called one was, I think, Three Letters to Lovers, and the other one was just called The Letters. I recently just saw both of them, and it's a great concept that I don't know how they were able to try and make two pilots back to back that had similar themes. And used even similar, they used some of the same footage. It was the idea that each of these stories had three different letters that got lost in the mail, and people thought different things about them until, you know, a year later when those letters were recovered, and then they found out the truth. It's a great concept.
Yeah, and if I remember, they had like, there was some kind of like a postal inspector that was it might have been Tony Franciosa, or I can't remember, somebody like that, some famous TV star, and he would personally deliver the letter like a year late, and, you know, she already had the baby, or she married somebody else, or...
And she thought that he didn't love her, but he had died, yeah. You know, things like that. It was a great concept.
Yeah.
I don't know how they would have made a TV show out of that.
Yeah, there's only so many things you can. I mean, it's basically the biggest cargo plane in the world, carrying all these different shows.
And you have Leslie Nielsen in one of them as a murderer, which is great.
Yeah, it's that did hit me was that it was two separate pilots. I guess they said we almost got it right the first time. Let's try this and we'll see.
Let's just do it with love cast, stories. I think the second one was just love stories, and the first one was not whatever. But it was fun. I just came across those. So yes, it took a long time for these letters to George to get across town. Or for Mr. Gower to get the telegram, who knows? And then Billy goes into the office to go take that important phone call from the bank examiner. You'd think that Peter Bailey would have been a little smarter than to let his absent-minded brother take care of all the finances, but we wouldn't have a movie if that didn't happen. I guess that's something that needs to be done.
Yeah, he had a heart of gold, but not much in the strategic thinking department for Peter. I guess it was kind of a favor to have him there.
Yeah. And then once Billy is away, so George just goes into his father's office and doesn't care.
Yeah. The only person to even acknowledge him is the rather dour looking fellow that is the I guess the wheelchair pusher for Mr. Potter.
Yes. Now I'm going to ask the question that is probably on your mind also. Okay. The Bailey Building and Loan is on the second floor.
Okay. Yeah.
Mr. Potter, without having to use magic, will not be able to get up those flight of stairs in his wheelchair.
Well, that's the secret of the building part of building and the building loan. They built a ramp that disappears.
I'm surprised that they never thought of it. It has always driven me nuts watching this. That how does he get up to the second floor? We don't see an elevator.
Bookcase is actually an elevator or a dumbwaiter kind of.
That's right. It's like in Batman, the TV series, the bookcase will open up and there's an elevator, there's a lift to bring him up straight into Peter Bailey's office. Well,
Or it's got two poles that says Potter and Potter chauffeur. It's just very, very peculiar. And this is
maybe Potter can really walk.
Yeah.
He looks both ways and gets up from the wheelchair and that's why he needs someone to take him because he lifts up the wheelchair.
You gotta remember it is a stinking hot day in May. I mean, look at the fans going, you can see the ribbons flying. Everybody's looking a little sweaty and Potter has a flannel blanket wrapped around his waist. He's obviously cold-hearted, but apparently he's also cold-footed.
That's right.
That's another kind of the wrong season for everything.
Yes. And the basically the rest of this minute tells us who Peter Bailey is and who Mr. Potter is at the exact same time. Of this conversation between the two of them, because Peter then goes, "I'm not crying, Mr. Potter." Well, you're begging. That's a whole lot worse. All I'm asking for is 30 days more. And then George starts interrupting. "Pop, just a minute, son. Just 30 short days. I'll dig up the $5,000 somehow."
Yeah, here, try one of these pills, Mr. Potter.
Shove me up, Pop. He wants Potter wants to get closer. He goes, "Just a minute. Have you put any real pressure on these people of yours to pay those mortgages? Times are bad, Mr. Potter. A lot of those people are out of work. Well, then foreclose. I can't do that. These families have children." "Pop, they're not my children." "But they're somebody's children, Mr. Potter. Are you running a business or a charity ward?" "Well, all right. Not with my money." "Mr. Potter, what makes you such a hard, cold character? You have no family, no children. You can't begin to spend all the money you've got." "Oh, I suppose I..." And then he gets cut off. But this whole conversation shows us that Peter Bailey is there to help the common man and Potter doesn't care. Now, my biggest question that I have here is why is Potter even investing in the building and loan? How is he making money here?
I think he wants to get controlling interest and close it down, and then there'd only be one bank. So why not just throw enough money in there to drown Bailey's? He'll own all of Bailey's, and then he can shut it down because they no longer control the bank the savings loan or the building loan that he has. I was trying to figure out, are Potter and Peter Bailey, are they the same age? Is Potter older than Peter Bailey?
It's hard to tell. I mean, again, this is 1919. Okay, this movie will go until 1946. So therefore, you know, we're going to have another 25 years of things happening.
Yeah.
Okay. So
Potter doesn't age though.
Potter does not age. Peter Bailey. My assumption is he's probably in his late 40s, early 50s. That would be my guess. But it's hard to tell exactly how old he is. I mean, well, let's put it this way. He's probably in his early 40s at this point, because he does live for another 9 years.
Yeah.
In the movie. And, you know, unfortunately the actor passed away 2 years after making the movie also. You know, Samuel Hines. You know, he died in 1948, and he was born in 1875. He was born in 1875, so he was 73.
Yeah, so he would have been 71 at the time of the filming.
Right. So let's say then at that point that he was, so he actually must be even older at this point. So from that perspective, I would say that Peter Bailey must have been older than Mr. Potter then at that point.
Yeah, I would think. I'm starting to wonder if George was adopted. It's just, or if he was somebody else's kid and they moved him in. If he's in his 60s having these kids, I don't think Mom Bailey was any younger.
Bailey, okay, the actress who plays Ma Bailey, Beulah Bondi, is 14 years younger than Samuel Hines. So there's a 14-year difference between them.
So she's still in her like late 50s, which would, I guess, yeah, could have had George is 12, so late or mid 40s. Yeah, I guess still.
Oh, she actually died on my birthday, at Beulah Bondi, in 1981 when I was 7.
Wow.
On January 11th, 1981.
Never had a chance to get her on the show.
No, sorry. Didn't wasn't able to do that. But let's see if this came out 46. Right, she's in her 50s in this movie, but let's look at it from the perspective that, you know, at the later parts of the movie, if she was in her 50s. So theoretically,
yeah,
her age fits.
She's playing younger, yeah.
That's right. But Peter Bailey doesn't work as well because of the fact that he, you know, spoiler alert, he doesn't make it through the movie. So,
yeah,
you know, when he does pass away, you know, 9 years later. So let's say he was in his 60s at that point, mid to late 60s. So at this point, he must be in his 50s then, not 40. So I will amend what I said earlier. So he's probably in his 50s at this point, early 50s at this point.
Yeah. The only other thing that I had as we run out of time here with him, one thing I noticed about the most prominent thing besides the pictures of his children on Peter Bailey's desk is he has a rather large notary stamp, which would mean Peter Bailey is a notary public, which, of course, under common law, it's a public officer constituted by law to serve the public in a non-contentious, he isn't a party to things, concerned with financial transactions, estates, deeds, powers of attorney. Notary's main function is to validate signatures of a person, administer oaths and affirmations, take affidavits and statutory declarations, and authenticate the execution of documents. So like you've signed off on buying a car, and he notarized it saying, yes, you did that. I saw him do that. And then they write down what they saw you do. So, and it's, you know, notaries play an important role in many different countries' legal systems, that you need a witness to do certain things, and the notary is the – that's his job, is to witness stuff happening. It's been around for, I think, over 1,000 years that somebody is almost 2,000 years. They were known in Roman times, as there were certain notaries that were there to hear testimony and then be able to swear to it in another location. So he's in one of the oldest professions there that is, you know, intricately tied in with banking. So I guess that's why that stamp, that embossing stamp, plays a prominent role on his desk.
Yeah, and I noticed two interesting things in his office also. When George sneaks in, when he opens the door, you see a portrait right in front of you, right in front of us, and just the only time you see it, he has a picture of Woodrow Wilson on the wall, and then later on, you can see that there is a picture of George Washington.
Yes, a small picture of George and a large picture of Woodrow Wilson.
That's right.
So,
So it's interesting. It again, it says a lot about Peter Bailey, you know, about who he is. You know, he's a man who believes in freedom, who believes in democracy, you know, and we know what type of person he is because of what he wants to, how he wants to help people and stuff like that. The only other thing I want to say about this minute is when Potter says, "Not my children," he like smirks. As if to say, I wouldn't want to have children. Why would you even think that I would want to have children? he's proud of that fact.
I did want to point out in Uncle Billy's office versus having George Washington and Woodrow Wilson.
Is that
Bill
Pershing?
Bailey had, that's Pershing. That's John Jay, Blackjack Pershing up there. Hero of a conqueror of Pancho Villa, and he fought in World War I. He was part of the National Army going over with the American Expeditionary Forces in 1917. He worked closely with the British Army in working joint ventures as allies in different mission operations. He had a very long and starred career, and then when he came back from the war, he became the general of the armies of the U.S. He was the highest rank possible for any member of the armed forces, and it was created especially for him. So, just amazing. I mean, he actually held a title that was higher than General Washington.
Wow.
So that's Billy's hero.
Yes.
So, that's what I have. An interesting week of minutes. They all are interesting, but it's just fascinating watching all this stuff, kind of the in-between going from one to another. We're setting up a problem that you're going to have to get resolved. Well, there's a couple of problems coming up, but this problem is going to have to resolve itself next week.
Yes.
In some way. Maybe not the way we wanted it to, but we'll see.
No, not necessarily, but we'll see.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, great. Thank you, Jim, for that. So every Friday we have a segment called Oscar Oops. The whole idea is that, every year the Oscars, have their voting and decide which movies will win which awards. But, I want to just focus obviously on the Best Picture award. And this movie was nominated for Best Picture in 1946. And it lost to what movie?
The best years of our lives. Fellow Liberty Films director William Wyler.
That's right. So, and
that must have been interesting times at lunch.
Probably. And basically, there have been many contentions over the years as to, you know, what movies should have won Oscars. I'm not going to get into the question about whether, you know, It's a Wonderful Life or Best Years of Our Lives should have won. But what I basically want to do is, you know, I've decided that this segment will be that, you know, my guests will then tell us basically the five movies that they think were snubbed that should have won the picture. The only caveat, obviously, is it must be something that was nominated. You can't just say, oh, I like this movie. You know, we all know that Jim likes, The Rocketeer, but The Rocketeer was not nominated. So some of your other movies were. Some of the others were. They might be on your list. So
No, this mine are all nominees. And I, as you may guess, I did think that they did the right choice with Best Years of Our Lives. And although it was such a great 1946 and 47 were such fantastic years for amazing films. The only reason that I liked that I think that Best Years deserve to win over It's a Wonderful Life was It's a Wonderful Life, great capper film, very much by the numbers. It is a typical capper film. William Wyler broke new ground with The Best Years of Our Lives, talking about taboo things like what we now call PTSD, which back at the time was called shell shock. And just the idea of trying to reintegrate these men who had basically saved the world and had come home to ordinary lives again and tried to fit in with a world that no longer existed. Capra still saw a world that didn't really change much. So it's a little bit different there. Not that I really love Capra films and I love It's a Wonderful Life, but I think for 1946 or 47, I think The Best Years of Our Lives was a good choice. Now
I do agree with you on that. Just so you know, you jumped the gun on me and did The Best Years of Our Lives minute by minute before I had a chance to. So, and that's not one. And that's not one I'm gonna,
If you want to go right. I am a firm believer in revisiting.
I did that on Die Hard.
It's good. But,
And I think you did a better job, you and all of the other guests or all the other guest hosts did a better job on The Best Years of Lives than on Die Hard. So,
it's always fascinating to hear different takes on the same minutes. You can hear two different takes and it's just, and you sit there and wonder, it's like, why did I not see that? Or where was that going? Let's get on with the action that I've found. I'll go in yearly order, but we're going to go way back to 1951. The way you want – if you want to win an Oscar, and I'll tell you how to do an Oscar, think of the people who vote for Oscars and make a movie about them, and you will win. And whatever you do, don't make a satire of the people who vote for Oscars. 1951, All About Eve, it's a very similar story to A Star Is Born. You have an older actress who's getting replaced by a conniving younger actress, and all the older actresses that were watching this movie thought, that's me and that's my secretary, and so they all voted for All About Eve. But the real winner back then was, people didn't realize it was a comedy until they watched the whole thing, was Billy Wilder's movie Sunset Boulevard with Gloria Swanson, about a washed-up silent star who was making a big comeback, and Bill Holden was her kept man, with a whole cast of people as varied as Buster Keaton. And I can't go into all the people that are in this movie, but Sunset Boulevard is just so cockamamie crazy, and it just lambastes the whole star. And I mean, Cecil B. DeMille is in this movie, and it's just so crazy, but it was so beautiful, and it was such a great takedown of the Hollywood studio system and how the world changes, and how all these old these old codgers ran Hollywood and thought it was working. It was the OK Boomer of its time. So I'd say 1951, Sunset Boulevard should have beat All About Eve, except for the people voting for it. Now we're going to jump all the way out to 1978.
Oh, you skipped 1970. I thought you thought Airport should have won.
No. I'm going. There's too many things in the 60s and 70s. Again, it's old guys, old people voting about things that they, that they remember. That's going to be better. 1978. I just want to, but before we get into the best picture, I just want to say something. The worst sin of 1978 was Best Song. Best Song, You Light Up My Life, Debbie Boone, beat Star Wars by John Williams. Now, admittedly, he won for Jaws.
What do you mean Best Song? Best score, you're saying?
Best score, yeah.
Best score. They don't have the Star Wars. Yeah, Bill Murray did a Star Wars song on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah. Best score. But You Light Up My Life, Ice Castles. Castles gets an Oscar, but Star Wars didn't get it for its music, you know? So that was, but let's get back to Best Picture. Best Picture, again, it's producers, of which Woody Allen was one. Rudy Allen was a producer. And producers falling in love with younger women. And so Annie Hall won. Annie Hall, I love Woody Allen movies. And they're all, funny. Annie Hall is one of Woody Allen's funniest movies. But it's about people in show business with younger women. And so this is when you fall in love with a younger woman, you got to vote for Best Picture. So Diane Keaton won Best Picture for that production, beating the paradigm shift in movies. Star Wars was nominated. It was nominated, and they couldn't figure out that this is where the future is going to turn into these blockbusters. They had a hint with it with Jaws, the first big blockbuster movie. But they didn't see this is what was coming. This is the thing that's going to happen. 78.
But you got to give them credit for the fact that they assumed that it was something that's going to happen because of the fact that they at least, acknowledged the fact of nominating it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. They did nominate it, but they didn't want to admit it.
Right.
So we get to 1980. 1980, just to give you an idea of some of the nominees, you had Breaking Away. Great story about what do you do after college? What do you do after high school? Where are you going to go? What are you going to be? Who are you going to be? Great personal story. You've got All That Jazz, which is it's almost like Fantasia for musicals. It went all over the map. We got Roy Scheider doing, he was in Jaws, but he's singing and dancing. You got Ben Vereen, and it's not like a normal musical, which is because it's Bob Fosse. Bob Fosse does everything backwards and sideways, and it'll never play on Broadway because you've got nudity and you've got sex and crazy drug taking, and he's popping Dexedrine while Vivaldi's Spring is playing every morning, and it's about, it's just crazy watching it, but beautiful beautiful editing, beautiful camera work, a stunning score, and really snappy. Script that didn't win. And then out in the Philippines, you had Francis Ford Coppola, fresh off Godfather, making the Vietnam movie. I know there's lots of other Vietnam movies, but this is the one. If you say, how about that Vietnam movie, you might think Platoon, but you don't think Platoon, you don't think Hamburger Hill, you think Apocalypse Now. Apocalypse Now is one of the greatest, it's the Ben-Hur of Vietnam movies. And it all got beaten by a divorce movie. It all got beaten by a divorce movie.
Kramer versus Kramer.
Of two people in Manhattan, two rich people in Manhattan, who remind the people that vote for Oscars what it's like to go through a divorce. And it goes through all the nitty gritty of how to have a divorce and fighting over custody. And it's the woman is the bad guy in this. Because the people voting for this are mostly the men, and they're voting, and it's a single dad. I know single dad shows. It's a single dad show, and it puts Meryl Streep has a paper thin personality in this movie. She's there because she's the bad guy, and beautiful camera work. The script is by the numbers, typical. It's a soap opera, and that beat Kramer versus. We're clemmed.
And we got two more.
Kramer versus Kramer beats Apocalypse Now, All That Jazz, and Breaking Away. I mean, just go back to sleep. So after Kramer versus Kramer, we go to the next year, 1981. 1981 had David Lynch's Elephant Man. Elephant Man, David Lynch. I mean, David Lynch is such an auteur. You know a David Lynch movie when you see it, but you don't know it's also a Mel Brooks movie. Mel Brooks had finished Young Frankenstein and Blazing Saddles and The Producers and The 12 Chairs. And then he wanted to make a dramatic movie. He loved the story of John or Joseph Merrick. But if he put Mel Brooks presents on the front, people would start laughing and waiting for the punchlines. So he renamed his company Brooks Films, didn't mention that he had any part in it. He's not on the poster. It's a David Lynch film. And the performances on it are incredible. All the makeup work on John Hurt, Anthony Hopkins is doing things. The John Gielgud is in it. Freddie Jones, shot in black and white in a world of color, and it has kind of a nightmarish, dreamlike quality in it. Doesn't quite tell the story linearly, but it tells it like you would think about somebody remembering a dream. Gorgeous cinematography. That didn't win. But let's go to another black and white film that comes out at the same time. Raging Bull. You had Robert De Niro, who gained almost 70 pounds, I think it was something like 65 pounds, to play both young Jake LaMotta and old Jake LaMotta.
For like,
and
it's for about like a five-minute scene.
Yeah, and it's got him, it's got Joe Pesci. You know, Martin Scorsese, you know, blood, sweat, and tears in this movie. You're watching Robert De Niro getting beat up for real. And it's just, you know, they all were doing this as seriously as they could. Crazy camera work. And not a lot of, you know, there's no narration as to what's going on. You have to just figure out that Jake LaMotta is not the smartest tool in the, you know, shed. And, you know, Joe Pesci getting into arguments with him as his brother. You know, it's gorgeous. It's different. And it shows what film is about. But none of that won. Raging Bull didn't win. Elephant Man didn't win. They picked a movie about a rich couple, rich family, Mary Tyler Moore and Donald Sutherland, you know, and their rich kids, who they have problems with their rich kids. One of them commits suicide. The other one's crazy and goes to Judd Hirsch to talk to his therapist. It's the language of the people making movies and their problems, rich people problems. So, of course, they vote for ordinary people. And that beats all these different, unique, breakthrough movies.
Well, which of them do you think should have won then? Because you just mentioned two. Which one would you have given it to?
That would have been tough, but I think I would have picked Elephant Man. I love the ending of it. I think Scorsese did okay until the end. He just tried to show I'm still here. He's got Jake LaMotta at the end of it reminds me of Steve McQueen at the end of Papillon. He's like, I'm still here. He reads a poem that Jake LaMotta wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that movie. I love boxing movies. My dad used to take me to Golden Gloves Boxing, and he knew my dad was a Boilermaker, and he worked with a lot of people. He worked with the Cinderella Man that you saw Russell Crowe playing. He used to work with one of the characters in the movie, two-ton Tony Galento, who he used to be the spokesman for Chock Full of Nuts, and he was a crazy guy. I met two-ton Tony Galento. Tony Galento told me once when I was a kid, he said that everyone you meet is a lesson, and it's a smart man who learns that lesson.
Oh, well.
So, you know, and it's like that stuck with me forever. And, you know, it's that kind of stuff. It's like the boxing world has a lot of knuckleheads in it, but you can learn from them. And the thing you learn from Raging Bull is don't be like Jake LaMotta. You know, appreciate what you have. So, yeah, ordinary people beat those great movies. But I would have picked Elephant Man just simply because it seems to have an uplifting, even though we lose him at the end, Elephant Man has an uplifting story. 1982, I understand, I like Chariots of Fire. That's a great story. It's good. It's historically accurate. But to me, it was two and a half hours of slow motion running. And I think the story could have been a lot tighter. I think they could have told it a lot better. The Vangelis movie just kind of – the Vangelis music kind of was overpowering. It's like meeting somebody and they've got too much aftershave on or something. It just was it was a little bit too much. I didn't think it was a very great film, but I didn't think it was good as the other one that was named that year, Raiders of the Lost Ark.
I've never heard of that.
It's a little known film. Yeah. It came out of Paramount. It was, you know, part of when they were making like Laverne and Shirley and stuff at Paramount. This came out.
Oh.
They didn't see what Raiders was going to turn into, or what it was going to kick off or continue on. That whole, you know, Star Wars, Raiders, all those movies that were coming out and trying different things by going back to, you know, the era of the 30s and 40s. So, yeah, so I would say I would have picked 1951 Sunset Boulevard, 1978 Star Wars, 1980 I would have probably picked Apocalypse Now, just simply because of the effort involved, and I would have picked Elephant Man and Raiders. So there's my picks on my alternate universe timeline.
Oh wow! Yeah, see, I was shocked that you didn't have either Airport or Apollo 13 on that one, on that list.
Yeah, they were. I mean, they were meaningful. And what was the one that won for 1970? There was something that came out.
1970 was Patton.
Patton, yeah, John Sturges. I thought Patton was a better movie. I mean, Airport was the original disaster film. It wasn't the original all-star cast. The original all-star cast was Grand Hotel.
Right.
But it was kind of, I mean, even for a disaster, it was kind of a by the numbers. Not that much different from than A Night to Remember. You're watching people trying to survive. It was very good. I enjoy Airport. Was it Best Picture? Compared to Patton, I'd say no.
Okay. I actually think it. I mean, it's going to be a long time until I talk about my list. But from 1970, whether it's on my top five or not, it doesn't matter. I think MASH should have won. I think MASH was better than Patton and even
it
Love
was,
Story.
Yeah, I mean it.
I mean, you had Love Story that year, and I'm trying to remember what the fifth nominee was. Can't remember offhand right now. The fifth one was, but it was below all of the others.
I could see, you know, MASH was, you know, Altman and being a breakthrough and just an interesting way of telling stuff, and it felt almost documentary style. It's very difficult. For me, it's difficult to give a comedy best picture, but yeah, it was. I could see the case to be made for Altman's MASH.
Right. The fifth one was Five Easy Pieces.
Ah. Okay. I think that was voted there simply because they had skipped Easy Rider, and they were Easy Rider, and they were trying to recreate Midnight Cowboy, saying this is a low budget now film.
Yeah, I actually not a big fan of Five Easy Pieces, so you know that for me that is definitely the lowest of the five.
Yeah, well, I think they were just trying to be relevant, so let's throw that in.
Yeah,
they were, you know, but it's, and again, I think one of the cases of Best Picture should be, it should rise above the year it's in. If something is dated, and I think Kramer versus Kramer is dated, I think Ordinary People is dated, I can't even say that about All About Eve is a little bit, well, All About Eve has some things that date it. When Marilyn Monroe is talking about I'm on television, what do I have to audition there, and somebody tell, I think it's I forget who it was, says, well, all of television is just an audition.
Right.
Wow. Well, yeah. Again, thank you for a wonderful week. I really appreciate
it. Thank you for joining me. I mean, you know, I know that I keep you up to all hours of the night to be able to record.
Well, likewise, I'm sure. I know I do that to you. So it's turnabout's fair play. We always have a great time on these things, and you always pick movies that we have things to talk about. It's not like you have to, you know, just start scrambling through Wikipedia. It's like, what can we talk about today? There's really nothing to say about this minute, but there's always, these things are jam-packed with stuff.
So, yes.
I think you make good choices on those, but thank you again for having me.
No problem. And I thank you for joining me. So why don't you, for one last time this season, let people know where they can find Jim O'Kane.
Okay. Well, actually, I want to, you know, you had said that you enjoyed Apollo 13, and we enjoyed making it. So I would recommend, go if you want to find us, go to apollo13minute.com. You can listen to the 1995 Ron Howard directed feature. Chris Henry and I go over it minute by minute, just like you're doing here with It's a Wonderful Life. We have astronauts, scientists, mission controllers, actors, and pyrotechnic people showing up just to chat about their little role in the movie or what the movie, how the movie affected them. We've even, I think we even talked to somebody who watched it in space. I can't remember. The one problem with talking about stuff, we try not to talk in the green room, as you do. We try not to talk before the show. Save it for the show.
That's right.
But we may have talked, I think we talked to somebody who was on the International Space Station and actually watched Apollo 13 in space. I can't remember if we got them to say
it's
that.
As I said, I've listened to close to 100 of those episodes, and I haven't heard that yet. So.
Okay. I usually don't go back and listen because I'm usually editing and trying to get the thing in, and I don't remember where all the conversations begin and end. But we did have my
favorite. Wait a second, there was an astronaut who was what was his name?
Charlie Precourt?
Charlie Precourt was on. Yeah.
I think he is the one that watched in space. Yeah.
So maybe he did mention that, and I forgot. You know, as we both say, we have so much going on in our brains, you can't remember everything.
Yeah, I feel like I tell the same stories again and again, but I don't remember. So if you can always hear a best of by listening to one of my other podcasts, because I may have said the same stories somewhere else. But I'm very proud. My co-host Chris Henry has the most wonderful address book. He knows so many different people. And we managed to get two Apollo-era astronauts on our show. We had Time's Man of the Year, Frank Borman, on the show. He's the first person to drive an Apollo Saturn V around the moon. It was stunning just being in his presence, being able to chat with him. And then Fred Hayes, who flew everything from a lunar module to a space shuttle. Here he is chatting on our show, and... both of us are trying not to fanboy like crazy. But here's the guy that the movie was about, who's in our show talking about what it was like having a movie made about you. So we had a lot of fun with him.
I'm surprised you weren't able to get Lovell on. Because I know that Chris has met him.
He had we got him at a bad time because he was in the middle of doing another big project for I think it was the Adler Planetarium up in Chicago where his Apollo 8 is, and he's from Chicago, so I think any Chicago area people get first place for Jim Lovell. But he was kind enough to talk with him, and I know he is really good friends with Chris, and he actually told the story. I mean, Chris told some stories about Jim Lovell that were amazing, like
the thumb
story. Yeah, he really does that thing where he puts his thumb over the moon, and Chris said, "I did the thing, he did it." So Chris is a lot of fun. He is just as ridiculously enthusiastic about space and space flight and space history as I am. So we were tag teaming, and it was like going to a some kind of a pajama party. You just sit up late and start talking to people about stuff. And we had a great time, and worth listening to. But Apollo13minute.com is where you can find it, or wherever, whatever podcatcher you're listening to, it's probably got our podcast on there.
All right, great. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Move Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter, and you can find me on my website, movearoundminute.com. So, Jim, once again, thank you very much for joining me. And
always a pleasure.
And I will be back on Monday with a new guest. But until then, have a great weekend and hot dog.
Hot dog!
I love you truly, truly dear. Life with its sorrow, life with its tears.